Okay, guys, welcome to episode 3 of our podcast 404, Cybersecurity Not Found. Today, we're going to be talking about a few different subjects. We're going to be talking about the NIS security standard that came out at the same time as GDPR, but which many people know little about. We're also going to be talking about, what else are we going to be talking about, Luke? I can't remember what else we're going to be talking about.
We are also going to be talking about end-to-end encryption and how that has played out recently, given like players like Zoom, stuff like that, what happened with the fallout there. And also marketing, how to handle marketing information and personal data, and also talk about the telephone preference service as well, which is a fantastic service that a lot of people don't know about. So if you hate nuisance calls, maybe that's something to look into.
Great. Yeah. Is that it then? We've just got those three. Yeah. So we've got NIS. We're going to be talking about end-to-end encryption over teleconferencing calls, and we're going to be talking about marketing and how to ensure that your marketing to individuals and to businesses, for that matter, is done safely and in line with GDPR and PECR, and maybe even talk a bit about the Privacy Directive that's potentially coming in soon.
Sounds good. Good one for Jack as well. He loves that e-privacy directive.
Well, I was thinking of Jack when I said it, to be honest. I've always got Jack in my heart, thinking about Jack.
Everybody needs a bit of Jack.
They do, yeah. How's the tie, Jack? All right? Hanging on the cupboard still?
Hasn't moved yet, I don't think.
No?
Haven't needed it.
That's a bad sign, though, isn't it? Anyway, never mind.
No, I've got plenty of rope.
Quickly moving on. Right, so shall we start then by talking about the NIS directive? Views. I've got some views. I'll hang back. Wait to hear from your views first. Who's got a view? Who's got a view on the NIS directive? What do we think of it?
Well, maybe it'd be a good idea to introduce why we're talking about the NIS directive as well.
Go on then.
We are very grateful for the suggestions that we get, the topics to talk about from people on our social media platforms, and we were given this question about what the NIS directive is and specifically how it's going to impact the British rail industry as a whole. As Dave previously mentioned, the directive, the NIS directive, isn't something that a lot of people have known about. I mean, we were asking around internally, and we got a good few of us were just like, had no idea. Including myself, never heard of it before, which is slightly embarrassing, but moving on. So yeah, the NIS directive is an EU-wide piece of legislation that aims to achieve a high common level of network and information system security across the EU. Now, in terms of Brexit and stuff like that, that's quite interesting, but that's going to be something else we talk about. But yeah, and so we are going to focus it at a rail point of view as well, but it's important to note that it applies to operators of essential services, including energy, transport, health, water, and digital infrastructure, and also digital service providers, which may impact some smaller players as well. So smaller cloud computing services, of which we have some of our clients as well, online marketplaces and search engines. So quite an interesting time for people in those sectors, I would have thought.
Yeah, it was interesting to get the comment, but I don't know what you guys think, but working in a cybersecurity industry and having gone through that period where everybody was sort of worried and panicking about GDPR, and then again, you know, with PCR as well, I'm quite surprised, to say the least, that I haven't heard more about NIS in the media, in the news. You know, you really would have thought that more of a fuss would be made of this, that there would be more discussion about it, more concerns about it. It almost seems to me like there was a big fanfare of GDPR and then a little toot from NIS. Although, you know, from my point of view, I mean, I can understand it to an extent, right? Because GDPR relates to individuals and everybody's an individual. At least I think that's how it works. So, you know, I can understand how with the mass populace that would get an interest. Whereas NIS, I suppose, is just, you know, aimed at specific sectors. However, those sectors that it does relate to are held very seriously accountable, you know, to this. And as such, I am quite surprised that I haven't heard more noise about it. You know, the operators of essential services and relevant digital service providers. And relevant digital service providers seems to encompass quite a large degree of potential organizations, doesn't it? Unless my understanding is incorrect, you know, that covers pretty much any organization that's offering provision of cloud services, which is a massive number. You know, so many people are doing that now. I can understand the reasons for it as well. Basically, what it seems to me anyway, intuitively, is that these are sectors where, if they're disrupted, would have a massive impact upon the economy and our ability to do business. So there needs to be some way of holding those organizations to account to ensure that they're doing what they need to be doing to make them secure from cyber attacks. And it specifically mentions on the ICO's website that the idea behind this is to ensure that people are putting measures in place to prevent being attacked by hackers. And, you know, there hasn't been much, has there, in terms of holding organizations to account to ensure that they're not being hacked. I mean, you know, it's a brilliant idea, but as I've said on LinkedIn a few times to a few people when we've been discussing this, it seems to be, and this is a consensus, it's not just my view, but most of the people that I've spoken to regarding this agree, it's a good idea, poorly executed. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I mean, firstly, I just agree with you because I think, as you say, there's so much out there, so many, what you class as a cloud provider nowadays is getting quite interesting, isn't it? Any kind of software as a service, any platform online could be a cloud provider. And that even, to be honest, up until, was it a few weeks ago, I didn't know this NIS existed myself. So that's quite interesting for me. And that a framework that could provide a lot of the stuff that we've always felt was missing has existed, but it just hasn't had the traction or the media coverage or, you know, the awareness that it deserves, I think.
Quite. What do you think, Jack?
No, I've got to agree with that. It's you've got to think, the only thing we see on the news is businesses have got to be prepared for GDPR. Individuals have got to be prepared for knowing what their rights are. You see a little bit about PECR, but you don't really see anything about any of the others, do you? I mean, it was a big initiative by Europe in, was it 2016, when they stated that they were going to change all this privacy stuff and make it uniform across all of Europe, and hence why GDPR, PCR and such all have been adopted. And the NIS directive was one of those things that were coming in as well. You'd have thought that there'd been a big push to get all of them, as since it's under the same umbrella, to be understood by sort of everyone. But at the same time, I can see that if the industries are aware of it, then other people won't really care, will they? As long as the industries are doing what they should do.
Yeah, it's not like as you said before, Dave. And GDPR was more a person thing, wasn't it? You know, like affects the individual, so people are more likely to think about it themselves. Whereas thinking about companies and organisations is a little less prominent to the average person, isn't it?
It's not something that people care about, is it?
Is it worth having a look? I think it would be beneficial to everybody if we sort of got a decent idea of, you know, who this applies to. So it's broken into these two categories, isn't it? Operators of essential services and relevant digital service providers. Is it worth having a quick look and a quick think about who those organisations are? So, you know, when it talks about relevant digital service providers, aside from sort of, you know, people hosting data in the cloud and offering that for a service, is there anybody else do we know that it applies to?
What do you mean? Like, so I mean, look at the list, like power, water, you mean that kind of thing, or?
No, well, they're the, okay. So, no, well, they're the essential services.
Yeah, oh, sorry, you're talking of, the other ones.
Yeah, the relevant digital service providers.
It's search engines, doesn't it? Search engines, cloud providers.
Would that extend to, like, platform as a service, though? So, like, if you talk about, I don't know, like an accountancy platform, like FreshBooks or like Sage Cloud and stuff like that, is that then a cloud computing service? And therefore, would Sage and other people like them be held to account by these regulations as well? I mean, it does stipulate that the regulations don't apply to digital service providers, which are considered micro or small enterprises. So that's less than 50 people or an annual turnover of less than £8.7 million. But there are quite a few, like any like reasonably sized organizations are going to be smashing that anyway. So
it seems to me sort of, you know, I'm actually on the itgovernance.co.uk website at the moment, and having a quick look at what they consider, because as we all know, depending on where you go, you seem to get different opinions when it comes to any kind of regulation. They're subjective, and that's something I want to talk about later. But they specifically mentioned online search engines. So obviously, you know, your Googles and your Bings and Yahoos. Then it stipulates online marketplaces. So by that, I would consider someone like, it says consumers, it allows consumers and or traders. So I'd imagine that, you'd have your eBays and, your Amazons. And then we have cloud computing services, which is provide a digital service that enables access to scalable and elastic pool of shared computing resources. So I think we're talking there about the ESXi, VMware, cloud computing organizations that are offering your ability to use software as a service, storage as a service facilities. So cloud computing services, I get. Online search engines, I get. I think the grey area for me is online marketplaces. What's considered to be an online marketplace in terms of DSP? So, I mentioned their eBay and I mentioned their Amazon, but, and that may be the case. But what about somewhere like, what about just somebody who has a website and they just sell a few products on the website? Does that constitute a DSP?
As long as they have more than 50 people and sell more than 10 million or turn over more than 10 million euros, then I guess it would, right? So even like something like Gumtree, is it a crisis if Gumtree goes down? Like, are they to be held to these NIS regulations? I mean, I know people love a bargain, but it's not particularly important for the running of the nation, which is where I understand the NIS regulations to be coming in from. Mm-hmm. So,
when I was in desperate need of a second-hand fish tank, I turned to Gumtree, and you could make a strong argument for the fact that that isn't a national crisis if I don't get my second-hand fish tank, but I have two young children, and it would have been definitely a household crisis if we couldn't have got that second-hand fish tank.
Well, so perhaps Gumtree are in scope. But even like, as you said, like smaller providers, like I don't know.
Who decides
how they've scoped it?
If it's not mandated, so the problem's going to be is if say I have one organisation, you've got another one, Luke, and we're both on the borderline. What if I decide, I don't want to go through the hassle. I'm going to read on the air of, well, we don't quite meet the criteria, so I don't have to. But, you want to be fully compliant and everything, and you decide you want to go for it. It's interesting, isn't it? So there's when you've got requirements that are kind of like you say, need to be a certain size, certain thing, and people can get a little bit creative, I imagine.
Yeah, they certainly wouldn't be the first people to get creative when scoping their compliance towards a specific standard or search. So
you don't say.
Yeah.
I hope you're not implying people shirking their responsibilities, Lou.
No, just prioritising other things we've seen.
Yeah, some very creative PCI DSS compliance from some organisations. You hear the stories, don't you?
Yeah. So again, just looking a little deeper into this, we're mitigating identified risks. DSPs, again, reading from the IT government's website here, we're mitigating identified risks. DSPs must take into consideration the security of systems and facilities, incident handling, business continuity management, monitoring, auditing, and testing. And DSPs are also expected to establish appropriate policies. Now, basically, these are all the things, are they not, that we would recommend to organizations when we're trying to ascertain whether they're secure or not. We look at the security of systems, we do data privacy impact assessments, we look at incident handling, we help with business continuity management, and probably at the core of our business is the monitoring, auditing, and testing of systems. So these are all things which all organizations should be doing anyway. I guess the difference is that if other organizations drop the ball, right, that aren't held to the compliance requirements for DSPS, then they can't be fined under that particular standard. However, they can for PCR and GDPR. I guess this is just adding a little extra meat to the bones, isn't it? So I was just going to say, here's an interesting one from a fines point of view, right? I'm presuming the answer is yes. Can you get fined for both? Because it's a GDPR's fine is what? It's about 17 million, I think, isn't it? Is it 17 million? Okay, as a maximum fine. Now, it's the same for DSP. So presumably, if you cock up with DSP, you're going to cock up with GDPR as well. So are you going to end up with potentially a £34 million fine?
But can I ask? So I'm unclear. So if I as a company, right, decide I want to not bother with the NIS regulations, right, is that going to mean that I can't get fined?
No, it's law.
Do you know what I mean? By enrolling, does that mean now I'm finable? Or could later on they say, well, Neil, your company should have been enrolled, and because you weren't, you were just trying to get away with it?
Yeah, I think you're just going to get slapped either way.
I think you'd get spanked, mate.
I mean, that's what I hope. That's what I hope, that you can't just avoid being fined by not signing up to the regulation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I haven't even thought to check on that. I just made the natural assumption that you'd get a spanking.
Just basing it on what they do with GDPR, you can register with the ICO and state that you are compliant and that you have a DPO and you have all these other things based on the criteria. And small businesses who don't need DPOs and don't need certain documents and procedures will just not need to, just like you don't necessarily need to register if you aren't processing personal data. So just because you think you aren't under GDPR, if it is found that you are and that you've broken the regulations, you're going to get fined. So I would guess that under NIS it'd be the same. It's a European directive that's come out to streamline across the whole of Europe. So they want people who are doing these activities that meet the criteria to be based under it. And if you actually register yourself down, then it's more of a, we know who you are, we've got a record of these. But if it comes forward that you happen to be a small time, because what is one of the you mentioned marketplaces, and the criteria that we've got here is just to conclude online sales and sales service contracts with traders, either at the online marketplace's website or a trader's website that uses computing services provided by the online marketplace. So it's even only just using the computing services provided by the online marketplace. If you meet that criteria and you have, is it more than 50 employees and earn more than 10 million euros, even if you haven't registered with it, you would assume that you're going to get told off. You should have registered. You meet the criteria, you're the type of people that were marketing this to and saying what you need to protect, so why didn't you? You'd think someone would come cracking down on them.
Yeah, in much the same way. I mean, what we can do, we could certainly pick this up in another podcast, I think, and look at that in a bit more detail in terms of the logistics of it. I mean, I just wanted to sort of touch on some other things related to the NIS regulations. So we've had a quick chat about digital service providers, and the sort of haziness, if you like, at least from my point of view, around what constitutes an online marketplace. So, as I say, online search engines, cloud computing services, that's pretty clear what they are. Online marketplaces, where, you know, exactly what that entails, what they consist of, I'd like a little bit more information. I'm going to see what I can find out about that. If anybody wants to make a comment, contact me on LinkedIn and give me some more information about that. I'd be very grateful. The NIS regulations applying to OES or operators of essential services. So we've got a bunch in here, haven't we? There's energy, transport, health, water, and digital infrastructure. So clearly to me that is firmly focused on ensuring that organizations that, if they were taken down, would have a big impact on us as a country economically and logistically, are going to keep their wits about them and stay safe. That's the idea behind it. Yeah, a little bit of offer them a little bit of concern and theoretically support to ensure that they keep us all safe, in fairness. But I'm a little concerned, if you like, about how this is going to work. So we know with digital service providers, for example, that the overseeing body, the people that hold those companies to account in terms of ensuring that this standard is met are the ICO. With regard to essential services, it's a pretty mixed bag, isn't it? You know, energy, transport, health, water, digital infrastructure. They're all sort of have a different body that looks after them in terms of applying, you know, making sure that the regulation is applied appropriately. And I've got a few concerns about that, and they might be unjustified in fairness, but what experience do these organisations have for ensuring that a cybersecurity regulation is adhered to?
I think that's
what do you think, guys?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point in terms of, so for like rail, going back to our listener's question, so then it's the Department for Transport, or for water, it's the Department for Rural Affairs, DEFRA. So I don't, like yourself, I'm kind of concerned about how much experience these organizations have on, well, more in terms of how much resource do these government departments have in order to investigate an incident or provide help and advice to organizations, which I know the NCSC do as well with their CAF framework for the NIS directive. But how can they help organizations and how can they enforce that these things actually happen? I mean, it's quite a large responsibility. And I think for like organizations like the large organizations like Critical Services, I feel like they should already be compliant with a lot of these things. I don't know what the rest of you guys think, but like when they talk about like having resilient networks,
why would this need to come in? I mean, I imagine they are compliant in lots of ways, or they do a lot of things they should do. This is kind of checking that those things are all done, though, isn't
quite
it?
Interesting.
And done to a good standard, I would hope.
Samurai went to a couple of rail industry conferences last year, and we were talking to a lot of the people there from companies, manufacturing trains like Bombardier and other people that work in the industry. And it was quite interesting the amount of like, when everybody talked about cybersecurity and rail, they all just kind of laughed. Like people just aren't aware. And we certainly weren't as aware going into these conversations with them, just how it's kind of like fallen by the wayside. A lot of security, because they're very old like systems, like you talk about rail in Britain, it's all from like 1900 and something. But yeah, just like security monitoring, I really hope that they already have it, but here we are.
I think maybe they have, and maybe you know the idea is just to ensure that they do it properly. I mean this leads me to another point as well, which is of concern. So my first point of concern is, are these regulatory bodies? Who is the have you got the list there, Luke? Who is the regulatory body for transport?
The Department for Transport.
That makes sense. So the Department for Transport. I mean, I forgive me if I'm wrong here, but I wouldn't have thought that the Department of Transport would have a whole heap of expertise in cybersecurity. I'm reasonably confident that if you grab somebody from the Department of Transport and asked him to explain how a Stack Overflow attack occurred, or a heap overflow, or even something more simple like an XSS or a SQLi, he would probably stumble over his words or her words. So are they the right people to be doing this?
I think yes and no, right? Great answer. But they are, in the sense of what they are. I think they've been chosen because they're independent bodies, aren't they, right? And that's what you kind of want. You want impartiality, independence on this. So on that level, yes. But as you say, on the level of understanding what needs to be done, you know, are the organisation doing what they should? Are they having the wool pulled over their eyes? All those kind of answers, questions, probably not. And that's where it becomes difficult, isn't it? Because you want somebody independent, but also you want somebody with expertise and knowledge.
Well, you've used the right word there, domain. That's what I'm thinking. So it's all well. I mean, even I'm happy to accept the argument if somebody turned around to me and say, well, look, we can make sure that policies and processes and procedures are being followed and adhered to without having to understand what a heap spraying attack is. Right, I get that. But what you do need to understand is the problem domain. So in other words, you need to understand what those types of risks the organization faces from a cybersecurity perspective are. And this particular directive focuses very heavy, doesn't it, on cyber attack. And you know, you're going to at least need to have a strong grasp of the different categories of threat, the likelihood of them occurring, and the ability to skim the news and you know, look at the cybersecurity feeds and make a view on what the threats are if you're going to be competent in the field. And I struggle to believe that those organizations that have a bunch of other things to do and other needs to meet are going to be able to become experts in cybersecurity and be able to enforce and you know, ensure compliance in this thing. It's
I mean, they're going to need a unit, aren't they? A dedicated unit within that organization to do this.
It is I'll be honest with you, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine, and it does get my back up a bit sometimes. And just putting NIS to one side for a second, but just in general, that is a case in point. This ludicrous notion that cybersecurity can be learned really quickly. You know, I'll do a quick CISP or, you know, whatever it might be. And I'll do a 1 week intensive course on CISP, and that's it then. I'm now an expert in cybersecurity, because it's total bunkum. I mean, you know, you guys know as well as I do, you know, you work in the field years and years and years and years to get that understanding of the risks and the intricacies and what best practice is and how likely something is to be hacked or not hacked, how much of a threat the people are. And you don't gain that from sticking your head in a book. You gain it through living it, you know, through doing incident response, through going out and meeting people. And I fear in these instances where, you know, we're in a situation where people need to ensure compliance and ensure cybersecurity are just going to be thrown into it. And they'll sit down, do a few training courses, and that's it then. They're the cybersecurity guy who's going to be put in place of ensuring that that SCADA systems don't get taken down by a zero-day attack from whatever country you choose, and I'm smart enough not to mention one.
No, but I think you're right, and I think my worry would be then, if we're talking about this, would be that you that's going to breed a checkbox atmosphere where someone's going to know enough, and what they're going to say is, right, okay, so I work for the Department of Transport. We're going to go and check out rail, so we're going to see a rail provider, and I'm going to then turn up with my tick box, which, you know, it's a starting point, but of you know, and asking questions like, do you have Cyber Essentials? Do you have ISO 27001? Do you get penetration testing? Do you have security awareness training? You know, I'm going to ask those questions, and I'm going to be looking for yes and no answers probably. And that's where there's the lack of detail. It's better than nothing, but, you know, we're back to that, you know, do you have X, Y, and Z? Yes, 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 no, no, no. We're going to lack the quality of the answers, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've just, Ruth just walked up with a sandwich, and I've just waved my finger at her and said, no, please don't bring that in right now. I didn't think a sandwich clattering plate noise would be, like, maybe even actually talking about it probably isn't suitable for a podcast either, isn't it?
I'm quite hungry, so yeah, this is.
We chose a funny time to do it, haven't we? Because it didn't work out on Friday, so we're doing it on a Monday. Doesn't have the same zip. What do you think? I think definitely.
Well, apparently the beers that you offered, that's. Well,
this is a catch up. This is a catch up from Friday, so we will do another one on Friday, and beer will be compulsory, I think, for that one.
Was that not what we were doing now?
I'm not going to argue.
Probably a bit much for a Monday morning, to be honest. So it's a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, yeah. Sat here talking about professionalism. I was like, yeah, yeah, these guys need to sort their stuff out. Just pass me that can of Carling.
Carling, I've got a bottle of vodka sat waiting.
I was going to say, does whiskey count as drinking?
No, it's AA. It's in the blood.
If you're doing a tasting, then that's fine. As long as you've got six different whiskies.
You're very loud, by the way, Jack. Have you got closer to your microphone?
No. My microphone's just attached to my head. It's the headphone one.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so you're
right.
Very close. So
I thought actually maybe you'd sellotaped a hand mic to your head when you'd said that, then.
I'll do that for next time. just going back to the like got off track, obviously. But just going back to the first part where you mentioned, like, there should be someone who oversees this, and the people, or if the person that they bring in, they're just going to be trained up and given a few videos to look at, and they're not going to be able to know it off the bat, are they? It's funny you say that, because it comes into what we were talking about last podcast, where people were self-certifying, and usually they bring someone in and they sit them down and go, this is your job now. Figure this out. And just looking at the domains, there are, just for the NAS thing, there are four objectives based on it, A, B, C, and D. And over that, there are 14 principles that they need to go over. They're going to need a team, realistically. If someone's going to want to implement something like this, they need a team to look over it. Because it's everything from managing security risks, which is all the paperwork, risk assessments and management. Then there's protecting against a cyber attack, and that's all the technical stuff, not just the theory stuff. Then you've got detecting cybersecurity events, so that's monitoring and anomaly detection. And then you've got things like minimizing the impact of cybersecurity incidents. So it's the four standard things you look into that you see in things like quality management and ISO 27001, where you've got to do a risk assessment, you've got to put in your protections, you've got to look into what could happen and monitor it, and then you've got to look into, you know, improving over time and minimizing any impact if it does happen. And it's things that you can't just have one person look over this, and you definitely are not going to be able to just say to someone who's working on a train, or because this, we mentioned about who this is aimed at, operators of essential services, and that are people like, what are they now? It's like rail managers, isn't it? These people are not going to know what these are. They're managers. They're going to have a team under them, and they're going to assign whoever they think is best fit. So I think while it is good to have it regional, and it is good to have each sector looking into it because they know what they're going to need, I think it could easily be abused.
I tell you where my concerns are, and I'm going to... You can't hear me, can you?
Can hear you.
Yeah, we can.
Can you? Oh, good. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I was looking at the... You know, you can't see it, right? But when I record the podcast, this is for the benefit of the listeners. There's a bar that I can see that has the where the sort of the voice jumps up and down. And it stopped working. It's working again now. It stopped working temporarily. So I thought I was talking and nobody could hear me. But then I thought, no, you must be able to hear me because you're not saying anything.
Can't wait to edit that out.
Right. It's staying in. I'm going to leave it in now. Just to...
You're the boss.
The benefit of the listener.
He who edits.
I tell you what, I will leave it up to Charlie's discretion. How much of that gets edited? How much of it gets left in?
Podcast is just going to be like 3 minutes long.
Anyway, so the point I was going to make is that it doesn't really work that way, right? In my view, in my experience at least, in the larger organisations, such as water and rail and whoever it might be, and I will use rail as an example because I have an anecdote, are not going to be doing it themselves, right? So, you know, your rolling stock people or whoever it might be, they're not going to be, ensuring that NIS is adhered to themselves. They're not going to sort of exert their own sort of expertise to make sure that they're ticking all the boxes. They will recruit somebody else to do it. Now, I can only give this example, and obviously I can't mention any companies, but I had an experience, and I've mentioned this on LinkedIn, I had an experience, it was probably a couple of years ago, maybe now, where I met with an organization who worked almost solely with the rail industry to ensure that they were compliant with numerous standards, including standards of cybersecurity and, you know, related activities. Now, the kind of organization that's going to be commissioned with having to ensure that compliance is met will be organizations such as this one, an organization which specializes in ensuring that the appropriate certification has been adhered to. So I went along and I met with this organization with a view that I could help them ensure. Do you guys get the doorbell? Charlie's got his work cut out for him. So I went and I met with this organization, and it was a very difficult, it was a very strange and bizarre scenario, right? Because I knew one of the people quite well, but the person they brought along I didn't know at all. And the person that they brought along, rightly so, if you think about it, was the person who was responsible for ensuring that software that is being developed for the rail industry is secure and safe. So I thought, okay, well, I'm definitely the right people in the room. So we had this, we started to have this conversation. Obviously, my remit was to explain how we might be able to help in terms of testing the software, doing secure code reviews on the software to make sure it's being written appropriately, to do a system penetration test upon the software to make sure hackers can't misuse it, to get involved with DevSecOps to make sure that the appropriate mechanisms for keeping it safe are being adhered to and used, and just a bit of brainstorming like we do with most clients, This didn't go down very well, right? So and I had the best intentions in mind, and it was a struggle because I was met with defensiveness from the other parties, in that almost like I don't know how it came across threatening. I really don't. I mean, I don't. Maybe I have a lack of understanding in psychology. I can't work this out. I can't see how that would have been met as a threatening comment, but it seemed to be. And what I was met with was I just basically being thrown a list of different standards, right? Security standards, a whole barrel of them. Some of them I knew, many of them I didn't, and the intricacies of them and what was expected for them, etc. And, I was being looked at and judged for the fact that I didn't know what all these standards were, right? Who was responsible for them, etc. And I just became increasingly frustrated that the logic of testing a system to make sure, pretending to be a bad guy trying to hack the system, why it wasn't clear that that is going to be the best way of finding out if the system is safe from a bad guy. You get a bunch of sort of really smart elite people who know how to hack software and get them to try to hack it. And then if they do, tell you how it was achieved, what you need to do to prevent it from happening again, and how you could write software in the future that would be less likely to get caught by that. That to me seems very logical. That logic just couldn't seem to. I think it must have hit home, but it was brushed to one side. It was almost like it was like my old man when he said to me the other day. He said, "Have you got your pension sorted out yet?" Right, and I said no, and he chastised me for it, and I ended up having a go at him. Right, I got defensive, and I thought, in hindsight, when I look back on that, right, I think I got defensive because he was right, and I didn't want to accept the truth. It was a truth that wasn't convenient for me, so I didn't want to listen. And I think this is what happens, isn't it? It certainly happens when we talk about cybersecurity and we talk about ways in which we can make systems safe. If it's a truth and it's recognized as a truth, but those processes and policies aren't already there, sometimes organizations push back against that. This one in particular did, and actually went on an attack almost. It was really, you've not heard of that policy, really, you've not heard of that security framework. I am surprised. It's a very very common and popular one. It surprises me that you wouldn't have heard of it. Those kind of defensive comments, and in the end, I got quite annoyed. I was very close to just saying, look, I'm really sorry for wasting your time. I'm walking out of the office. It was only my professionalism that kept me in there. But it did make me realize a few things. It made me realize that a lot of the time, two things. First of all, people are frightened of testing, and we need to accept that. And as an industry, think of some way of not coming across like people to be scared of, not coming across of people to be worried about, not being viewed as somebody who's going to get them into trouble. And outside of that experience, by the way, in a situation which I don't want to talk about on this podcast, But it has happened again recently with a very large organization. That same kind of, you know, not wanting to be tested, fear of being discovered that something is wrong, and preferring to be in a position where they can say, oh, right, okay, we got hacked. Sorry, we didn't know anything was wrong. And taking that risk, if you like, of that happening to them over having a preemptive test first to see whether the system's secure. But in case that test comes back and says, no, you're not. And if it comes back as no, you're not, it might affect sales. It might affect the ability to put a system in place. It might affect a client relationship. So there's this, there is this terrible fear, isn't there, in the industry of testing. And where it leads in this particular instance, just to bring it full circle and move back to this situation with the provider of certification and standard compliance to the rail industry, is it seemed very much to me the priority of that organization was to get the certifications, to get the rubber stamps. That was clearly the overarching ambition of the entire organization. If the company became more secure as a result, to me at least, that felt like a fringe benefit, almost like a, you know, like a positive side effect of the fact that they've actually got the certification, rather than the security being the most important thing and the certification being secondary. We're moving into that scenario now with so many standards, so much certification, and it's so subjective in terms of interpretation that it loses its teeth. I don't know. What do you guys think?
It comes down to, like, as you say, it's the rubber stamp, it's the certification, it's the stamp of honour, it's the name. They see that and think, if we have this, we look better. If we have Crest, then yay, we've got it. But they don't think about the whole ins and outs, what they need to do to get that. They just want the checkbox sort of process, don't they, to get there.
And it's like previously said about some certifications, like you can be quite creative in how you scope compliance with certain things as well, which presents an issue. But just going back to your point, Dave, like I think perhaps if people sometimes need to look at it in a different way, like with their like fear of testing and stuff like that. Like if you were told that if you knew that one of your parents had like a hereditary disease or something like that then could affect you, and you were offered, would you like to be tested for it? I mean, surely most people would say, yes, I would like to be tested. In fact, I don't know, what would you guys all want to be tested for that? Like, it's the same thing with testing, right?
Well, I would say that, yeah, on the basis that you can then, in essence, not deal with it, but you know what I mean? Like, you can work around it. If the more you know what's going on, the more, in my opinion, you can then start to act on it. So if you do find out that some of your systems are weak or your processes are not there, you know, then you can deal with it. And I think the point is it's a risk and reward, isn't it, right? And if I don't know about it, I can carry on. And you know what, if the big bad thing happens, I'll deal with that at the time, versus I'm going to have to put some effort in now. And that's going to reduce the chance of something bad happening later. And I think a lot of us suffer from this. And going back to the psychological point, sometimes it does come down to kind of, do you remember the test that they did on kids, where they give them, I think they give them some sweets, don't they, right? Or they put some sweets in a room, and they basically say, if you leave these 5 sweets, you know, for 20 minutes, then you're going to get 20 sweets. And I can't help but think that, you know, in a bit of what Dave said about the psychological, is like, it's kind of a bit like that, isn't it? Kind of like, you know, basically dealing with it now, putting the effort in and getting a bigger reward, or i.e. less of a risk later.
You can have one now versus, or two in 20 minutes, I think was one of them that they've done.
And I do think the psychological element comes into it a lot, to be honest, because as you're saying, you know, whether it's people feel threatened or people don't want to deal with it, it can get quite personal, because it's, you know, it's your area. And if you're a software developer, right, and some problem is found with your software, you know, that you might take that personally. And the point is, it's, as we know, it's easier to find problems with software than it is to, you know, see, it's hard to write software, right? It's easier to find problems, in my opinion, with it, because you only have to find one thing wrong. They have to fix everything, which is
for sure, like
classic line, isn't it? So you're there to help. Yeah, you're there to help them and help them fix those holes. And the fact that they've produced all this awesome software is great. but you know, it needs to make, you need to make sure that software is, you know, 100% sort of looked after.
Well, look, do you know what? A couple of things spring to mind. The first one is, I know you've done that 23andMe test, haven't you, Neil?
I have, yeah.
Although you managed to successfully do that anonymously. I wouldn't do it, right? I wouldn't do that test. And it's interesting, isn't it? You stop and think, well, why is that? Why wouldn't I do it? Well, there's the anonymity thing is firstly. And then there is also one that I can't really be asked. That's another good reason, but probably the
that's also a reason that we've been told before, Dave, from the security side.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. No, very good point. Yeah, the analogy's there straight away.
I'm retiring soon, so I really don't want to cause any problems before I retire.
But there is a part of me that thought, well, what if they find something really bad, like I'm predisposed to X or Y condition, or, you know. And there's a bit of me that thinks, ah, screw it, I just don't want to know, right? I just don't want to know because there might be something in there that upsets me. So, is there a difference between those things, or is it the same thing? And I suspect it's probably the same thing because increasingly I'm hitting it now, this reticence towards systems being tested, particularly if the decision maker is tied in with the system. So in other words, if the decision maker, let's say for example somebody said, okay, do you know what, I have made a decision that I'm going to onboard this particular system, and then they get offered the ability to have it tested, and they say no, because if it's tested and it's found to be bad, they wouldn't say this of course, if it's tested and found to be bad, it's going to make me look bad because I've sanctioned it already. I mean, you know, that goes on. That's something that we've seen. But how do you fix it? And to me, other than saying, look, that's not what we're about, right? You know, that's not what the industry's about. It isn't about getting anybody into any trouble at all. It's about preventing people from getting into trouble and preventing systems going down. Because, you know, you can't just bury your head in the sand and pretend all is well. You know, it's akin to running up massive credit card debts, and you know, people who just stop looking at the balance because it frightens them. I mean, I do it to an extent. Letters come through the door, and I think I don't want to look at that. It's going to be a statement, and it's going to upset me. You know what I mean? So I do it sometimes to a point, but then I think, come on, you've got to do it. And once you've done it, you feel better for it, because whether the news is bad or good, you can do something about it. You're in a proactive position. But burying your head in the sand, you know, if something is wrong, it's just going to get worse. I've spoken to loads of people about it. How do you get people to understand that we're not the bad guys, that we're trying to make things better? And unless, as an industry, I feel, unless as an industry, that we can fix that fear of penetration testing and cybersecurity people, we're not going to get an awful lot safer.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that, to be honest, that, as we've already touched on there, there's lots of areas that affects health, finances, cybersecurity, and it's definitely a psychological and a human issue to sometimes deal with it. And it's quite difficult, isn't it? And I think to underpin a lot of this is it's also a trust, isn't it? Because if you're going to invite an individual, a company into, you know, to work with your organization, so a trust relationship is so important. You want to trust that this organization is going to try and do sort of the best for you and work with you and help you, isn't it? You know what I mean? Try to get the best out of it as well.
Well, you wouldn't be doing yourself any favors if you just went in there and stitched people up, would you? You know, if it was a big finger pointing exercise, where's that going to get you? It'd be suicide, you know, as a business model. Yeah. Should we move on? Because we're a bit... Has anybody else got anything else they want to say about this? Or shall I move on? Because we're at 52 minutes and we normally only do this for an hour and we've got two topics left.
Maybe, should we just go to one topic?
I think maybe. So let's make a choice then and we'll do the other one next week. Do we want to do end-to-end encryption for teleconferencing? Or do we want to do marketing TPS and other things and stuff such as those, as it says here on my list?
Ah, very, very good.
Should we do marketing and stuff and TPS because we've got Jack? and he's not a resource that we always have.
Hi.
Okay, fair enough. I fancied end-to-end encryption, but I'm happy to be outvoted. Right, marketing TPS and other things and stuff such as those.
Get that reference, somebody else, please.
Okay, so we've been involved in this recently, haven't we, with a client where without going into details of who and what and why, whereby we've been, you know, looking at trying to ensure compliance in order to adhere to the ICO. And where, so can I throw questions at you, Jack? Is that a good way to do it? Because you're good at this stuff, aren't you?
Absolutely.
You're our resident CIPPE.
We can always edit out the stuff that I go, I don't know. So.
Well, I think we're already down to a podcast that's actually. So when I said 52 minutes, everyone was probably thinking, what? It's only been on for 10.
Yeah. Oh, that's got to get edited out as well.
Some serious editing.
Good luck, Charlie.
Brilliant.
Right. So here's the thing. TPS, Telephone Preference Service, which is a service that you sign into to ensure that you don't get spammy calls, or to try and ensure, let's be honest, it doesn't always work because loads of people ignore it, particularly those companies that are overseas. And then we have everything related to PCR as well, don't we? So we have whether somebody can be contacted via telephone. Shall we just go with telephone? We're a bit short of time. Somebody can be contacted via telephone if they have had an appropriate legitimate interest assessment done, that at the end of said assessment, it appears that there's good justification for making that sales call to that particular individual. And then we have consent, don't we, where an individual actually ticks a box affirmatively saying, yes, you can ring me to try to sell me a heap of stuff. Probably not in those words. So where does one end and the other start? So, for example, if I am not on the TPS list, does that mean, regardless of consent or legitimate interest, I can be called?
So it's a little bit muddy waters. You've got to know where they got the information from. They can't just take your information from, let's say, they've bought it off someone to then use, because they haven't got that consent to be able to use information that they just purchased, unless the person that they have purchased it from has, or the company that they've purchased it from has stipulated that, you know, the person who's given them it has consented to this. So the one that we've been working with recently, without mentioning any names, they tend to use, at least the data suppliers use surveys, and it'll be things like win an iPhone, and it'll say in the thing, you're going to be happy for us to send this information and share it with other third parties in these sectors. And they'll list either particular companies, which is what you should do, or sectors of companies, which just state these are the types of businesses that may get in contact with you. Then they'll use the information you've given, like the date of birth, age range, address, to forward that onto you. But when it comes to things like that, they tend to use legitimate interest, because they only have the consent to transfer that on. And then the company that's contacting them would be using legitimate interest based on the fact that they've said that they would like to hear from certain sectors. The problem is that you're supposed to do a balancing test, as you mentioned. So it was a legitimate interest assessment. And it's where you weigh up what your reasons are for contacting them, why you're contacting them. You know, you've got to have a good one. It can't just be we need people to phone. And you've also got to weigh up the rights and freedoms of the individual. So would they realistically be expecting to have a call like this based on what they've put down or information they've given? If there isn't any real world expectation, so yeah, fair enough, there's putting down the sectors that they can contact or that can contact them. But if there isn't any real world expectation, then you're breaking the law, because it's just unsolicited calls. Now, it does go, I know you've only mentioned for telephones, but it does go into a bit more detail when it comes to emails and such, which requires proper consent, not just legitimate interest. But when we're working with telephones, I would say consent is key. if you have clear consent from someone where they've stated unambiguously, yes, it's okay for you to call me, text me, or whatever, then you're in clear waters. You're fine. That there's more than likely not going to be a complaint in. And if they're on the TPH register, consent trumps it, because, you know, they can get in contact, they can talk to the people they've consented to talk to them, because they're allowing it. But if they're on the TPS register and you haven't got consent, legitimate interest wouldn't apply. And I know you mentioned before it was all about not being on the register. So it's I always direct people to the ICO's website, because there's a lot of stuff there on PECR when it comes to marketing calls, texts, and facts. And a lot of places look things like marketing by telephone, by email, text, fax, using cookies on websites is exactly the same with PECR. And there's a lot of information on the ICO's website, but
what about a situation where a legitimate interest assessment has been completed? I'm going to give you all scenarios here just to try and catch you out, because that's the kind of nice guy I am.
Oh, I like this.
What about if a company gave a legitimate interest assessment had been completed? The legitimate interest said, yeah, that's all right. Contact that person if you like. It's all boxes ticked. Subjectively, I have to add, but ticked nevertheless. And then, but that individual, right, is on the TPS and they receive a call. Has a law been broken?
That depends if you've checked. What you should do is check that they're on the TPS register. Dip testing or just random selection. It's always better to have a dialer. Or whoever it is you're using to actually scan.
You're not getting off the hook that easy. So I've tested and I know, right, for sure, they are definitely on the TPS register. This person is on the TPS. This is on the do not call TPS register. But
oh, you broke up a little bit there, Dave. I only got to but.
I mean, I think I can tell what Dave's saying. And yes, I think the law would be broken if under legitimate interest.
I'm there with you on that, Luke.
You can't use legitimate interest for that. You need to use consent. If they're on the TPS register, you need clear-cut consent that they one of the things is one of the rules on live marketing for TPS with the PECR is anyone registered, so you must not make unsolicited live calls to any number that is registered with the TPS or CTPS register unless that person has specifically consented to it. Even if they're not a customer, even if they bought something from you, even if you've sent them marketing before, if you find they're on the TPS register, they've stipulated that they don't want to be contacted for marketing, and that should be it.
I wonder, it'd be quite interesting, like, as a percentage, if we can find that out, like, how many legitimate interest assessments actually, like, state that then they cannot, they don't pass their own legitimate interest assessment. Like, do you reckon that actually ever happens?
I mean, it's bound to at some point, if someone's doing it properly, but it comes on to what we were talking about before with self-assessments and with the NIS directive. People and companies are going to fudge it a little bit, aren't they? They're going to put whatever they can and whatever they think in their own minds, what they can put to be able to pass that. Oh yeah, we've done all these tests, we've balanced it up against it, and our legitimate interest is much more important than the freedom and rights of the individual. Definitely.
You see, I disagree. The use there when they say the company's legitimate interest, I don't, in my opinion, isn't it the legitimate interest of the individual?
So it's based on it's a balancing test for your interest or the interest of your company and the processing activities that you're doing against the legitimate interest that the individual may have in your product. But there is always, because a company, there's always going to have a legitimate interest to have.
I was going to say, there's always, the company would always have, he's definitely now interested.
That's everything up.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm basically at
two. You are back.
Oh, Mike, issues, eh?
It's gone very quiet, anyway. Dave.
Right, so it's no secret. I haven't told anybody, but we have had a meeting, haven't we, recently with the ICO on behalf with the client. And one of the things that came out in that meeting was the meeting went very well, by the way, and no wrongdoing was found, and the case was dropped. But during that meeting with the ICO, it was very clear, wasn't it, that they did not like legitimate interest assessments at all, and in fact specifically said. One of the ICO people specifically said, I get suspicious whenever I see the use of legitimate interest assessments. And I have to say, I do too a bit. And again, it was stated that consent is always the gold standard, if you like. So reading between the lines, to me, that stipulates. So what I take from it is this, okay? If you're on the TPS register, you can't be called off the back of a legitimate interest assessment. Presumably, though, Jack, if you're on the TPS register and you give consent to be called, consent will trump TPS and you can then be called. Is that correct?
Yes. So consent is key there. The only thing it stipulates is that if you are on the TPS register, the only way they can contact you is if you have specifically consented to that company calling you.
Which probably... brings on to the next point, like if you're not registered on the TPS, you probably should do, like your mobile, and also if you're watching in black and white, your landline as well.
You made my brain go funny there. I'm like, but it's an audio. Are we on video here? What's going
on? If you're tuning in on AM radio, then register your landline.
Okay. So what? So basically, I bet I sound a bit better now, don't I? I've just realised the microphone fell down a bit. So basically, I think that. So legitimate interest assessment isn't sufficient to be called over if you're on the TPS. Consent is, if you've specifically requested that company can call you back. And to cut a long story short, the ICO don't particularly like legitimate interest assessment to be used as a means to justify calling somebody.
That's the headline there. That's the kit there. That's because anyone working in sales and marketing, that's exactly what they want to know, isn't it, really?
Cool. All right. So are we done?
It's all good for me.
Anybody else got anything they want to say?
I'm very hungry, so I would also vote for being done. your sandwich must be sat there staring at you, Dave.
I know. Well, it's not, actually. I'm in the home office and the sandwich is in the house. So I need to go in. For that. All right, so quickly then, before I go, just quickly say a word to please visit our website, samuraisecurity.co.uk. All the podcasts are on the news section of that. All our blogs go on the news section of that as well, and we blog regularly. And please do say hello to me on my LinkedIn account, and say hello to us on Twitter and on Facebook too. The links for which are on said website. All right, guys, thanks very much for your time. We'll talk about end-to-end encryption for teleconferences, and then whatever other suggestions you've got, let us know on LinkedIn, and we'll take those on next week. I want to say next week, actually, we'll be recording it on Friday, and you'll be hearing them next Monday. All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for your time. Thanks for listening, and talk soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.